This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians this week. My name is Joe Ruiz, again filling in for the MIA Chris Spangle. We are once again hostless as far as the president of all libertarians is concerned. But with
Dear
me
leader.
Anyway is Greg Lenz.
Hey, Joe. How are you, buddy?
Good. And you were always kind of the Riker to Spangle's Captain Picard, right?
Well, you know, I was more of the yin and yang. He was the libertarian and I was the villain he needed.
The villain, the scumbag Republican?
Exactly. It's kind of like Batman needed the Joker.
Well, tonight we have, speaking of Batman, we have Batman with us tonight. Batman, how have you been this week?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah. That, ladies and gentlemen, is our friend Dan Van Doren.
Mr. Van Doren, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you tonight?
Doing well. Good to see you. I haven't seen you since down in Columbus at the Indiana Libertarian Convention.
Yeah, that was really good food. I had never had such a poorly cooked burger before.
Well, you know, Columbus is a little bit weird. That's they're kind of like the, I guess they've been excommunicated from Indianapolis, so they went down there and set up their little weird city.
Yeah, they served my martini in a plastic cup. I mean, how much more tacky can you get?
Quite
Dick's
classy.
Cup martinis. Well, for those who don't know Dan Van Doren, Dan was the media producer in my 2012 bid for the U.S. congressional seat here in Indiana's 2nd District. And he is also a very prominent libertarian in the area. Dan, can you tell us how you became a libertarian, kind of what you feel your role is in the liberty movement, and you know what you do just kind of on a day-to-day basis?
Well, my journey really began when I was about 17 years old. I listened to a 1940s radio play that featured an essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It was about how there are laws in the very substance of nature. What you do, if it's right, it's going to come back and it's going to improve your life. If you do what's wrong, it's going to harm it. I was really fascinated by that because we're told a lot that if you're going to be a good person, you have to be self-sacrificing. And that really got me thinking. And then my whole journey really came to its conclusion when I was 18, my senior year in high school. I ran across a book called Whatever Happened to Justice by Richard J. Maybury. It was basically the same theme, but it went much deeper into it and then applied it to an actual political and economic philosophy, which, of course, is libertarianism. And I stayed up the entire night and read the book cover to cover. It was basically an almost haunting experience because I had a complete reversal, politically speaking, overnight. You always hear people say that you can't change overnight. No, actually I did. I went from a complete neocon to absolute Ayn Rand-style libertarian in 24 hours.
Now, Greg, I didn't give a damn about politics at all when I was 17, 18 years old. Did you care?
I didn't care probably until I was close to around 21 whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
To
and
me,
so here you have a total libertarian transformation. That's impressive in the sense that he was 18, but also impressive in that he already had a political ideology before he jumped ship.
Yeah, exactly.
At
I mean,
young age. It's amazing.
I guess you can call neoconservatism an ideology, can you, Dan?
Yes, you most definitely can. It's more like a religion, though. no facts to it, but just a whole lot of faith.
Merca.
Merca. Freedom.
Because freedom.
What else do you need out of freedom, right?
That's right. Let's go blow some shit up. Merca.
Speaking of freedom, now, Joe, you actually wrote a piece this week that got quite a bit of traction, and it was essentially advocating laws because you have become quite the anarchist. And quite the underminer of the state, I guess you could say. So what exactly did your article talk about? And why do you think it, hit a nerve with so many libertarians?
Well, there was a point where I had, and I mentioned this in the piece, I, a couple weeks ago, wrote a Facebook post about doing yourself a favor and going out and breaking a law, because I figure that there are so many laws on the books that don't hurt anyone or their property, which is, you know, so it doesn't violate the non-aggression principle, but there's still a law against doing things that shouldn't really be laws from a libertarian standpoint. So I wanted to start a series of articles where I took the most insane little minute laws that they don't hold a very high penalty and just say, you know what, let's go out and break those laws because we have an obligation to break small laws that are pathetic. There's no chance of you hurting yourself or hurting anyone else or damaging anyone's property, then let's just go out and break them because we're free people and we have to just take a little bit of freedom for ourselves, especially when the consequences, I mean, they are pretty minimal. So this one was about running a red light. And I just had this idea where I pulled up to an intersection and there was nobody around. The light wouldn't change. And so I decided to just go for it. And sure enough, I crossed the street, safely got home, no problems. But I wanted to know what would happen, you know, if I had been caught. And so I started calling, you know, the legislative information desk and the BMV and different places trying to find out, you know, what the real penalty would be, what the law said exactly, what the consequence was. And nobody really knew. And I get the impression that it's probably like that a lot with a lot of these little minor laws that are on the books that nobody really has time or money to enforce. And so we should just break them and ignore them and disregard them. And so that's kind of what I advocated in the article. But I went ahead and sent it to Jeffrey Tucker because he's become a friend of ours. He said it was hilarious. And then I went ahead and sent it over to our new friend Walter Block. Walter Block is amazing. And he said, that was a fascinating piece. Let me send that to a couple more friends. He sent it to Robert Windsor and Lou Rockwell. So now we can just name drop because there's been important eyes in the libertarian movement, I guess, on We Are Libertarians papers. And then Liberty.me shared it online. The Bastiat Institute shared it. And we've had an influx or an increase of Facebook likes and Twitter followers since it's been posted in all these different areas. So I figure that's how you measure the success of an article. People can read it and say, huh, because we don't necessarily have to go out and break crazy laws like DUIs or anything like that. That's obviously that's senseless. But we can find these little things that nobody's really going to argue about. I mean, who am I hurting by running this red light when no one else is present?
Now, anyone that gets a ticket for running a red light, do they tell the police that you will actually reimburse them for the ticket?
The beautifully libertarian thing about this policy that I'm advocating for is that you do so at your own risk.
Not on me, bro. Not on me.
Don't send me your tickets. They won't get paid.
So let me ask you this. Have you today broken any laws?
Today?
Mm-hmm.
I listened to a burnt CD.
Ooh.
The music on as such, I did not download myself. But I'm fairly sure it was not downloaded off of iTunes or any legal online store.
Okay. So you still are living dangerously.
Living dangerously, yeah. Just walking the line like Johnny Cash.
And Dan, how about you? Have you broken any laws today?
Well, to be quite honest, I don't care enough to keep track if I actually broke a law or not. Because I remember reading something that the average person commits 3 crimes a day without even realizing it. I honestly do not... I don't take into consideration what the written political law is. I just make my decisions off of if it's going to harm another person or not. And that is such a good guide to use, but you will be inadvertently breaking several arbitrary laws, which you would do anyway. So I just try not to worry about it at all.
But see, I feel like we need to know them because it gives us something, it gives us cause for celebration. You know, so we were always taught on the minarchist end or, you know, on the government end, know your rights. Make sure you're familiar with the laws. Make sure you're familiar with what your rights are. So if you're ever put in a sticky situation, you know how things are supposed to unfold. And you can be vocal about that. Well, I have, you know, a little bit of a different strategy right now. Let's just know the laws and know our rights so that when the time comes that we break them, we can be happy about that.
You know, maybe we need to organize like a libertarian celebration day where we... We for the whole year, we write down all the laws that we've broken, and we write them out maybe on individual Post-it notes or pieces of paper, and we get together and have a big bonfire party.
Yeah, and we can listen to some iced tea.
Yeah, exactly, some NWA.
Yeah, and it'll be like a libertarian confessional.
Yeah, it'll be...
Forgive me, government, for I have sinned. These are all the laws that I've broken this year.
Now, what we should do as great...
Obama.
I'm sorry, what was that, Dan?
Say 10 Hail Obamas.
10 Hail Obamas, and that will buy you out of your speeding ticket for the year. We could even do it like Dingus Day up in South Bend. Have you gone to a Dingus Day party up there?
No. No, you know what? When I moved to South Bend, I was kind of out of the element, and then I eventually had kids, which kept me out of the element. So any sort of parties or anything that go around on here, I just don't know about them.
Even the Masonic parties?
Masonic parties are like pancake breakfasts. There's no alcohol.
It's like the Indiana National Guard after they go out and stare down Michigan on the border, then they go eat pancakes afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the early bird special.
Well, that's interesting, though, because you don't hear too often in it's interesting. There are certain elements and strains of libertarians that advocate, like agorists or voluntarists, like Maya Axton that's been a contributor to We Are Libertarians, that advocate two things. They advocate breaking the law because, like Jefferson said, and as you quoted in your piece, if a law is unjust, a man is not only right to disobey it, but he's obligated to do so. And so Maya has always told me that we should break the laws on a massive scale and then pray that they enforce them to the full extent because it would overwhelm the judicial system.
Yeah, Maya's a lot more confrontational than I am. I have a wife and I have kids that I have to consider, and I have to kind of weigh the risks and make sure that daddy doesn't end up in jail because there's too many fathers in jail out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's still room for all those little things that you don't even consider on a day-to-day basis. Like Dan said, most people break the law at some point, don't even realize they're doing it. If the speed limit's 65 on the bypass and I'm going 70, most people go about 5 miles over the speed limit. And that usually keeps them out of trouble. But it's still technically going over the speed limit. That's okay. All I'm saying is to do it with a smile on your face because you're taking some liberty for yourself.
Exactly. Now, what do you guys think as far as some more practical applications of liberty? How do we apply liberty in more of a daily basis? What are some ways?
Well, I say look for anything you can. So if the government tells me what kind of light bulb that I have to use, you know, if I have access to another light bulb, maybe I'll use that. Jeffrey Tucker in one of his books was talking about how, or they put a regulator on his hot water heater. So he went and basically ripped that regulator off. That way he could take a shower at whatever temperature he wanted. And he said it was a glorious feeling to take a hot shower and know that it wasn't the government's defined temperature, but it was comfortable for him. And he said that was a beautiful thing. So it's little things like that. In my city, there is an ordinance that basically says that as soon as it snows, you need to shovel your sidewalk. And if you don't shovel your sidewalk within a certain period of time, the mailman can choose to not deliver your mail because it's risky for them to walk on icy, unshoveled paths, right?
Yeah.
So I just say, okay, I can go an extra day without my mail, you know, but I'm going to go ahead and choose to just not shovel my sidewalk today because I can't. Those little things that we can take.
And hey, that's not such a bad idea because, quite frankly, the Postal Service is bankrupt. So the less mail they deliver, hopefully, the more they can stay in business and save those union government jobs.
Yeah, you're kind of being a good steward with taxpayer dollars in the same, you know, moment of defiance, right?
Dan, what about you? What are some ways you think that you can apply practically apply more liberty to your life by breaking laws or through other avenues?
Truly, the most effective thing you can do is to literally not give a crap. If, like what Joe just said, I know this is nitpicky finding an objection with it, but it'll demonstrate my point. The light bulb thing, he said to choose a light bulb that they don't want. Well, if it's a light bulb that you do want, and they're mandating it, that's a coincidence. Use that light bulb anyway. I think the most effective route that we can take is not to act out of rebellion, but to act out of self-interest.
Do what you want to do.
Do what you want to do and act as if they're not even there. Now, fight them, of course, but in your own personal life, in whatever direction you're headed, live by your own rationality. Don't take them into consideration.
Yeah, I'll concede that point. I think that was well said.
Now, is there, for you guys, like I know Joe had recently just said that there's a point where it becomes harmful to his family. So that's sort of where he draws the line. Dan, do you have that same red line that you try to avoid?
No, I will take any opportunity I can to do what's right.
Well, okay, let me stop him right there, Greg. He says that. but he works for a living, mm-hmm. and so he's paying taxes. And my guess is he's going to continue to pay those taxes because he knows that he'll end up in a Wesley Snipes type situation if he chooses not to. And we all think taxes are silly, and we all think, you know, people should be able to work and keep the money that they earn and not have to give it to everyone else. And it's ours, right?
Exactly. You earned it. It's yours.
But he's still going ahead and contributing to that. He's not attempting to fight the tax system. So maybe that's the line where he says it's not worth it.
I have been, but I'm not going to say on the podcast how I do it. I'll just leave it at that.
I'm actually defrauding the government right now. I just can't tell you about it.
And Dan, you work in the hospitality industry, so I would imagine individuals in that same industry would know exactly what you're talking about, correct?
Yes. Whenever they've paid an exorbitant amount in taxes, I've noticed that they're always very receptive to the libertarian message. I wish I could get them receptive, you know, constantly, but it's just every 2 weeks when their paycheck comes and they don't get any of it, when it just all goes to the taxes to cover their tips. That's when they give a crap.
When it hurts your pocket.
Yeah.
That's like Ron Paul used to say, that people vote from their bellies. Mm-hmm. And when they start to feel hungry and, you know, the food's not on the table the way it used to be and the money's not flowing in, can't keep money in savings because of bad economic policies, that's when people start to come over to our side of the aisle.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I think you see sometimes when in a – that's part interesting you say that, because in a lot of countries, when there are tough economic times, it's been – or what I've viewed and I guess I most remember – is that the more populist politicians who rail against greedy corporations and rail against corporate cronyism and different things like that end up becoming sort of the savior, and they tend to consolidate power and rise like a Hugo Chavez or like the leaders you see in Venezuela right now. And it's unfortunate because the very things they advocate for and hope to and give hope to the citizens who maybe aren't as well-educated on economics and free markets, they end up forming this supermajority that can only be overthrown through revolutionary measures or mass civil disobedience like we're seeing in the Ukraine or in Venezuela right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now I actually was thinking about some more ways to practically apply it, and they're not necessarily illegal yet. I know one thing for me is, you know, if you're out there listening, buy as many things in Bitcoin as you possibly can. The more you can buy in Bitcoin, the less sales tax, the less money that's going to go to the government, and they absolutely hate it right now. Like, I know we'll probably talk about it on a later podcast, but recently a Bitcoin wallet, an exchange, went down, and a lot of Bitcoins were stolen. And it's funny, the media immediately said they blamed it on hackers. And for me, I thought, well, who has the most to lose from this? Granted, you know, rogue actors, rogue hackers on the deep web probably do. They have a lot of financial gain, but the government has the most to gain by doing this and making it look like an unsafe form of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just keep waiting for someone to say, well, have we checked with the NSA? Have we checked with the CIA? Have we checked with any of the cyber defense divisions within the FBI?
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say that one of them aren't acting on behalf of the federal government in order to disrupt confidence in Bitcoin?
Now, do you invest in Bitcoin?
I do. I do, in fact.
Okay.
I don't use the one that was recently hacked, but I am a big believer in Bitcoin. As a bare minimum, I think it's an asset. Long term, I really do hope and I'm not saying it's going to be Bitcoin. It'll probably be a second or third variation of Bitcoin. But I do think that a cryptocurrency will become the international de facto standard.
Dan said he doesn't own any Bitcoin either.
No. I don't trust it for the fact that it can be so horribly basically held down by government action. I might agree with the idea of a privately produced currency, but that doesn't mean that I have to sacrifice my money to it, because I really don't think Bitcoin is going to last, one, because of government crackdowns, two, it's not based on any intrinsic value such as a precious metal. I think that I'm not sure if you're familiar with the old Dutch thalers. They would in Holland, they would produce 1 ounce coins of silver. That's actually where we got the word dollar. and they would be used all over the world. They were viewed as the standard of trade. Anyway, I think that something more along those lines is what we're going to see in the future, but I don't think that's going to be for a little while. I think Bitcoin is kind of a social revolution against the Fed, against all centralized banks, but I don't think it's going to last more than a decade. But eventually, as things continue going downhill, I think that there will be reemergences of currencies such as these, and they'll become stronger each time they do emerge until finally we do revert back to that.
Are you saying, though, that you don't think they'll be digital? You think it's going to be something tangible that we can hold in our hands?
Yes, because there's too much. We're literally talking about magnetic waves when we talk about anything that's digital, electronic. It's not something that's tangible. It's not metal. It's literally ones and O's.
Now, Greg, since you are an owner of Bitcoin or an investor in that currency, that cryptocurrency, would you agree or disagree with what Dan just predicted?
I actually find the intrinsic value to be different. I find it to be anonymity. And then I find it is a more efficient means of exchange. And the reason I say that is because it is based on a decimal system. And so instead of paying a penny, and then clearly when you're paying a penny, it's a set price, but that may not be the true cost of what someone's willing to sell it for. So you might be overpaying if really they wanted 99 cents, 0.98754, blah, 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 blah. And it creates I think that's why, for instance, in the financial world, you have currency arbitrage, because a lot of times you see currencies being they're naturally misvalued because they're not they're not based on a decimal system where you can have an infinitesimal amount of digits. And I believe that the anonymity and the ability to escape taxation, and then also Bitcoin's beautiful means of exchange, are where that value is derived. And I personally would argue that's actually more beneficial than gold. Gold is a precious metal. Silver is a precious metal. In reality, I would probably say that rare earth metals, like the ones the Chinese have been hoarding in Australia and probably going to go into Afghanistan eventually and get those, that are used in cell phones, have more utility than gold or silver. But I think it's just a difference
stuff.
Of opinion.
Well, if you're talking about utility, then of what possible value is Bitcoin?
Anonymity. And it's a more efficient means of exchange.
Now, Greg, I still don't know a whole lot about Bitcoin. Tell me how it can be anonymous when it seems like the NSA and different outlets are looking at everything that we do kind of online. I joked this week that the U.S. Department of Interior started following We Are Libertarians on Facebook, and I said now they're officially watching us.
Yeah, well, I never liked that. I mean, that's never a good thing for us, although I keep waiting for in our Facebook chat, instead of it saying seen by Joe or seen by Creighton or seen by Spangle, I keep waiting for it to say seen by the NSA, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Seen by NSA operator 01273.
But as far as Bitcoin's ability to be anonymous, right now the principle is similar to like a Swiss bank account in that it's dealt in numbers with no actual identifier. Now, in a Swiss bank account, granted the bank knows who the actual account holder is, but with Bitcoin, since it's essentially a numeric transaction, it's pretty darn it's tough to trace. I mean, I still think there's probably a way to trace it. I think in time it will be hacked to the point we will be able to track transactions. Is it there yet? No. But I do think it will be there in the future just because it is inherently a system, and all systems can be hacked.
And yet, despite the anonymity, it's almost unnecessary because people who use Bitcoin are very vocal about the fact that they use and support Bitcoin.
Oh, I mean, I believe it was the Golden State Warriors were actually selling tickets in Bitcoin, and they would accept. You could buy tickets for the Golden State Warriors, and they would take it. And it actually makes a lot of sense because right now the dollar and various government currencies are still the de facto standard for conducting business. So right now Bitcoin is an alternative. Well, it's similar to how gold's an alternative to dollars. When they're not the de facto, they tend to be more of an asset and lead to hoarding. Especially in the United States, like we have Fort Knox. We've now various people have debated whether we've leased out our gold to guarantee our debt. But, like, for instance, Germany recently called a certain amount of U.S. gold, and we were not able to meet the obligation. And that's a pretty big red flag to me, because that shows to me that people are wanting to hoard an asset, not necessarily have gold be a means of exchange. And so that's why I would compare it to a Bitcoin.
Okay. Well, I think we should probably at some point get a little bit more in depth with the whole cryptocurrency movement on the show. I know that we had kind of a set agenda and it didn't include that tonight, but as we move on here, maybe we can make a mental note of that. We should go a little bit deeper if we have the opportunity soon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, I mean, Bitcoin's just one way. Some other ways, I think the biggest way that you can apply liberty is to record any interaction with a state or government employee.
Sure.
Anytime it's a police officer, anything like that. In my opinion, if they're going to spy on us, we have every right to, in fact, turn the massive surveillance state right back on them and demand accountability. And that kind of goes back more to Maya's argument, is if you're going to hold us to a certain standard, we are, in fact, going to hold you to that standard until you're ready to adjust the laws and give us back some of our liberty and privacy.
Well, and I love that, you know, and I love the idea, too, of trolling the government a little bit. Like, someone told me today, well, if you start writing a series of articles about you breaking small laws, even though they're small, you're basically incriminating yourself. And I said, yeah, but I could just tell them I was lying about it. How do they know?
You are known to be a jokester.
What's that?
You are known to be a jokester. You could have been being facetious.
That's right.
If I have to
came to my door and said, hey, we heard you did this. You ran a stop sign or something. There was nobody at the intersection. You just blew the stop sign. Well, okay. Do you have proof of that? Because I was just telling a lie. I just, you know, I wrote that to be funny. Or I was putting myself in the shoes of somebody who could potentially do that because of a philosophy that I believe in. Now, you're going to arrest me for that? You're going to give me a fine for that? What are you going to do? And I don't think they can really do anything.
Yeah. If I had to do a deposition for you, I'd say, no, Joe is known to make jokes and just be facetious. And that way, that way you wouldn't be arrested and then put in the Barack Obama's change and yes, we can gulag.
You know, I sent you an article today about these things that they're installing in South Bend, and they've put them in bad neighborhoods here and there across the country. But it's called Shot Spotter. Dan, have you heard about this?
I have not.
It was in the South Bend Tribune today. They're basically microphones that they're implementing or they're installing, and the city of South Bend spent $300,000 on these microphones so they could put them in the crime-heavy neighborhoods of South Bend. And basically what it does is anytime there's a gunshot, these microphones pick up the signal and send a GPS signal to the police so the police know exactly where it's coming from, and they can go and investigate the crime scene immediately, see the shells, and it kind of gives them a leg up when there's gunfire. I sent a text message, and I want to write about this soon, to the reporter from the South Bend Tribune who sent this article out named Aaron Blasco, and I just said, can it only pick up something that is loud as like a gunshot? Or can it pick up voices, conversations, et cetera, also? Because the way that the chief of police in South Bend worded it was, the microphones are listening, right? Which seems kind of, for a libertarian, that's a red flag, I hope.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so when I saw that, I asked this reporter that question, and he says, well, the chief of police says that it can pick up other sounds too, but that nobody should have an expectation of privacy in a public place. And I said, all right, well, if that's the case, then I think that those of us who are jokers, if we're willing to put ourselves in a crime-heavy area during the day or whatever, should just walk through and say the most ridiculous things. You know, I left the body on the other side of the river or something like that. And, you know, and obviously there's going to be no other evidence to put you up against anything that happens, but, you know, troll them, because if they're going to spy on you, like you said, you deserve to kind of give them a hard time too.
And it is. It's absolutely a backdoor, because now the video surveillance is something that was already dangerous enough, but a lot of times it lacked the context to be able to convict someone or be able to be admitted as evidence that wasn't just circumstantial and not allowed. When you pair that with audio, if you use that correctly, that's Skynet. That's the ball game.
Yeah. That's person of interest.
Mm-hmm. And they are, of course, they're a Washington, D.C.-based company. Shocking. Absolutely shocking. And then, I mean, so the best way to fight something like that is, I guess, create awareness in South Bend. I don't know if that's something that's popped up or how that even got implemented. Have you followed it very much?
Well, apparently they approved it last August, and they reported about it then, but it didn't get on my radar until today when they said, okay, these things have been installed now. They're going to start using them.
You know, I wouldn't be shocked if Vladimir Putin decided to buy that.
I wouldn't either.
I'm kind of curious, since Rashad and I are going to be eating a lot of Mexican food, if we go down to South Bend and we fart really loud, will that be mistaken as gunshots?
It depends on the type of fart. If it's one of those rapid fire in succession, most likely. I don't think the technology is able to discern between one and then just a continual rip.
Assault farts.
Yes, assault farts.
Yeah, watch it work in the opposite. Like all of a sudden you're wasting taxpayer dollars responding to assault farts and different things, you know, and wasting the police officer's time. Meanwhile, there's a gunshot on the other side of town.
I would love to see
with Dan and Rashad.
I would love to see the South Bend police just come storming down on an 80-year-old granny on a walker that just had some beans and has the walking farts going down the sidewalk. That would make for great television.
You think I did what?
Well, speaking of Putin, have you been following this situation today, the developments in Russia and the Ukraine?
Did you get the pun there?
The what?
Speaking of Putin.
Yep, exactly.
All right, go ahead.
Oh, you know what? That was totally over my head, and it was my own pun. Worst libertarian ever. But yeah, I didn't know. Dan, have you been following this situation much?
Not as much as I would like to, but from what I've seen, it's really interesting.
It is. It is, in fact, it is a test of U.S. foreign policy more than anything I see. It looks like an absolute role reversal from our dabblings in the goings-on of the rest of the world.
Well, we went into it pretty deep last week, and we made some predictions, and you know, we had a lot to say as far as the history of the things that are happening in the Ukraine. Tell us from last week up until now what's been happening, and how has that shaped your thinking about the situation at all?
It has drastically shaped my thinking personally. Russia and the Ukraine have obviously an interesting history. Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. They won independence, but part of the Ukraine is this autonomous republic called Crimea. And I may be pronouncing that wrong, so I apologize if I am. And so they actually have their own government and president. They try to live as independently of the Ukraine as possible, but it's a peninsula that sits right on the Black Sea. Now, a lot of their population identifies themselves with the Russians. And in the Ukraine, the eastern part of Ukraine and Crimea have always been more sympathetic to Russians than they have this free and independent state of Ukraine, because they've really wanted to be independent themselves. Instead of the Ukraine granting them that that ability, they've sort of annexed them and allowed them to exist kind of like Texas in the United States, if you will. They kind of exist autonomously within the U.S. And today, the Russian troops, Putin had authorized in the Senate, the Duma in Russia, allowed him to send troops to the border. Today, they authorized the troops to go in and take Crimea. And in fact, the Ukrainian Coast Guard has removed all ships from the ports on the Black Sea that were under Crimean control. And now they are under Russian control. The airport is under Russian control. The media is under Russian control. Radio stations, you name it. And the fact of the matter is, there are people that are really upset about it in that area. And then there are people that are sort of nostalgic about it and feel like, you know, the USSR is coming back. And it's been really interesting to watch Russian coverage of the news, U.S. reactions from the various punditry, and then the president and John Kerry, and then the history of that area. It's a very Muslim area, which for Vladimir Putin could pose quite substantial risks by immediately seizing it. But it is very important for him from a Black Sea access perspective.
Why exactly?
Well, it's a peninsula, and the Ukraine. Geopolitically, there are certain areas in the Black Sea where Ukraine really had in Crimea being one of them, had greater access to the Black Sea than even Russia. And so by taking this establishes Russia as the dominant player in that region for shipping, for various war games, things of that nature.
You said that they had the Russia has control of the media now in Crimea.
They do.
You sent me some links to some propaganda that's been sent out, and tell the listeners about that, and what do you think that means?
Well, I mean, Vladimir Putin's actually He's trolling.
It was kind
of
funny.
He's trolling the rest of the world via the Russian media, and it's. I hate to say it's funny because ultimately we're talking about the removal of sovereignty from a group of people who wanted to be sovereign from even the Ukraine in the first place. But he had the Russian media show all these pictures, and I sent them to Joe, and some of them are like a soldier passing out sandwiches, and it's a celebratory atmosphere in Crimea.
And they're shooting selfies with the citizens.
Yeah, they're taking the, these men with AK-47s are getting selfies. There's supermodels with the, like, all these attractive women want to be with the Russian soldiers. It is straight farce. It is Wag the Dog at its finest.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks a lot less like this whole takeover just happened and more like some of these, you know, Crimean, Ukrainian people were walking around in some sort of a theme park.
Exactly. Like, it was a joyous invasion. It was
instead of Mickey Mouse, though, it's a guy in a camouflage.
Exactly. It was Blitzkrieg with a smile, if you will. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, he is trolling Barack Obama like no one is even capable of in the United States. The media coverage today here, John Kerry came out. He said that there will be consequences for such actions. Chuck Schumer said that they'll impose economic sanctions. Mike Rogers, Republican chair of the the House Intelligence Committee, he actually was very, very critical of the president and said, right now Vladimir Putin is playing chess and the United States is playing checkers. And President Obama just – he comes out and he says there will be consequences, but there's – I don't see how he can do anything. We are warred out in the United States. We didn't do anything in Syria. We didn't even want Libyan intervention. We have been fighting a war for 11 years, and he knows he's hamstrung.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, his view of the world is – he didn't even want to support this new Ukrainian uprising by sending troops in and the United Nations because he firmly believes that democracy, self-governance has to be organic. And if it's not organic and it's us playing a role, then it will not last.
Well, you know, it's funny. It says that they shared words. There was an article in the New Yorker where Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin had a phone call and that they seemed to – here's the exact quote. It said, Obama and Putin spoke on the phone today for an hour and a half. The White House and Kremlin accounts of the call add up to what was clearly the equivalent of an angry standoff. Lectures, counter-lectures, intimations of threats, intimations of counter-threats, but the leverage, for now, is all with Moscow. And it's funny, that illustration to me is so funny because Obama and Putin, they always remind me of this very bitter divorced couple trying to raise a child while they both think that they're the better parent and they think that their parental strategy is the best, and while they can refrain from throwing punches on weekend visitation, you get this kind of vibe that they always want to.
Yeah. Oh, I think that the president has been an academic his whole life, you know, really until he got into the Illinois state legislature. And I think he had this view of the world that people want democracy, but you can't necessarily export it like George W. Bush's belief, that we have to take the neoconservative role and go out and try to increase human liberty by helping people attain human freedom through different government institutions. And I think he believed that the world isn't necessarily a bad place. It hasn't been a Hitler. There hasn't been a Stalin. There hasn't been someone like that that controlled a major world power until Vladimir Putin. And I think that is really causing the president to reassess his view of the world, especially foreign policy intervention.
I'm going to dominate you all for Mother Russia.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I know you guys are both very in libertarian policy. Foreign policy is non-interventionist. That is the crux of the libertarian position.
I was actually going to shoot you a question, Greg. You know Casey Hendrickson. We had him back on the show report. He's a radio host in Northwest Indiana. And he makes complaints about the libertarian foreign policy all the time because he says it's not actually a foreign policy. Not doing anything in his eyes is not a foreign policy. And he said, the reason that people don't respect it and the reason that people don't come around to it as often as we believe they should is because all we're saying is the government shouldn't do anything. And, you know, how do you, before we get into how that applies to what's happening in Crimea with Russia, how do you tell people who don't necessarily believe in a non-interventionist foreign policy, as someone who I'm sure kind of came over from a different place, used to be the scumbag Republican and everything,
mm-hmm.
How do you explain that?
For me, I look at it two ways. One, there is no gold standard, if you will. There's no red line that exists for me. I asked Ron Paul when I got to interview him at DePaul when he spoke, and I asked him, it was when Syria was going on, where does your red line exist? And so his response was, it does not affect me until it is at my border. And I feel like that is, I just can't entirely get on board with that, because I feel like it's the Switzerland approach. You know, it's, oh, gladly we'll conduct business with you Nazis while the Jews are being slaughtered. Or gladly we will do X, Y, Z. From an economic, I don't think that military intervention is the right response every time. But I do think that I'm okay with economic sanctions. I'm okay with what we do to Iran if they're going to be expansionist and decrease human freedom. You want to decrease human freedom and you want to force people to convert to Islam and not allow religious freedom, great. I'm not going to necessarily send in troops, but I sure as heck am not going to let anyone do business with you, and I'm going to starve you to death. I will do that. I don't have an issue with that personally. I know that is not the libertarian position, but I just struggle being okay with not doing anything until it's at your doorstep.
Well, I'm actually a huge proponent of the Switzerland position, because if you think about it, the way that we view foreign policy, we look at our nation's history and we think nothing could have been different. We sided with Russia over Germany. There wasn't any other choice. That was absolutely the right decision. I think that if we would have had a more non-interventionist philosophy, we not only would have avoided the Pearl Harbor incident, because you always hear people say that we were isolationists up till World War II. No, we were conducting all kinds of economic measures against Japan before World War II, and that's why they attacked us. We were very involved in world events. And you see, Germany, they had such a self-destructive philosophy. This is going to sound anti-Semitic at first, but think about it. They completely beheaded their entire financial sector by imprisoning all the Jews. That was their entire argument against them, that the Jews controlled all of the economic power. Well, they got rid of that. We always think of Nazi Germany as some sort of economic superpower. They probably produced about 10% of the tanks that Britain and the United States did. They were literally about the same strength as Russia. When we sided with Russia, we only made the lesser of the two evils a little bit stronger. Switzerland, they didn't side with either one, and yes, they did allow business. But we should have allowed the two, let's call them evil empires, to hash it out, and they would have been so crippled they couldn't have done any harm, and they would have imploded on their own anyway. All that I think we did was we prolonged a huge problem, and we're still standing in the shadow of it. Putin is a product of us allowing the Soviet Union to exist a little bit longer.
What do you think about that, Greg?
I personally can't do that. It's not necessarily the... I get the Switzerland approach. I understand it. But the Holocaust was such a... It wasn't a libertarian. It wasn't a political thing. It was a human thing. It was, we are going to let people be slaughtered because a certain group of people doesn't like them. We still allow that today. We allow it in the Sudan. We allow it in Nigeria. We allow it all over Africa, where various warring groups go and slaughter each other. And it happens. I understand. I really struggle with that. I say, so I'm acknowledging it's okay and it's not my fight. And that's just a position for me. If I have, and I wouldn't go about it the way we did. I am, if you know me at all, I think the best weapon is the one you only have to use once. I would have been, if I were in Harry Truman's position, I would have used the nuclear. I would have used it. I would have hit them once, hit them so hard they would never think about acting out again. That's my personal opinion.
You take out innocent people doing that.
What'd you say?
You take out innocent people doing that.
That's the only, if that was the only option, yes. If I had an option where I had the intelligence where I could take out a Hitler and his top, and then I could rapidly infiltrate and overthrow through a coup, or if there were other options, I'd consider those, and I'd want those to be number one.
Let me get this straight.
Mm-hmm.
You would want to halt the genocide, the mass murder, by just nuking a huge square foot area.
Correct.
So all the people in the concentration camps that you're trying to prevent from being harmed, you're just going to take them out for the sake of protecting them?
No, because I know where they are. So, for instance, I would use a weapon that would maybe have a 15-square-mile radius.
And then they would blister away from radiation poisoning.
Yeah, no, if that's the case, if there was another weapon that was more damaging and I was able to be, it was able to be more targeted, I would absolutely use that. That's just me, though. That's where I kind of part ways with the libertarian philosophy. I cannot, if I know there's a wrong that is it's a human wrong, and I am not able to get humanity to come to the help and not have to resort to that option, I am going to err on the side of taking action versus not.
I will say that that's one of the hardest selling points of the liberty position to people who are not libertarian. When you talk about foreign policy and when they bring up, you know, situations like what we're talking about here, and you tell them, well, it's not my fight, you almost kind of come across to them as a bit soulless because mm-hmm. you're not willing to take some sort of measure. And from us, there's economic ramifications. We think about the unintended consequences. There's a lot of intellectual arguments. They don't see that. All they see is there's people that are in danger and you're not willing to give them your hand.
Exactly.
So there has to be, I mean, there has to be a way that we can, you know, hold our ground in terms of what is our fight and what is not our fight. But we have to be able to at least understand that you have to be able to help people that are in need at some point.
And my real distinction there is if it was socialism versus capitalism, if it was political ideology versus, you know, various political ideology, that's not our fight. When it becomes a human thing, that's where I feel that if I have the ability, I have the responsibility.
The way that I always measure it out, too, is I have to see that before I am saying let's advocate for some sort of intervention, the people of that country who are being oppressed, they have to be doing everything within their power to take over, to start a revolution, to say this is what we want, because you can't help someone who's not willing to first help themselves.
Exactly. So Ukraine is not our
fight. Measuring stick.
Yeah, like in my opinion, the Ukraine and Crimea, that's not our fight. Would you guys agree?
Yeah, but there's a lot of conservatives out there who are basically giving the president grief for having not pulled the trigger on that already.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's a wrong belief, in my opinion, because that harkens back all the way to, like, the domino theory. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it is an interesting world, though, right now. China isn't the global leader that people expected. They don't play a role in this type of thing very often. They tend to say, all right, what's the most economic beneficial perspective, and that's the or strategy, and that's the one we're going to follow. We don't really care about anything else. But I don't know. I just wanted to hear your guys' thoughts and how the proper way to diagnose this Crimea position through the framework of libertarian foreign policy.
Now, we talked last week about how a lot of the Ukrainians wanted to be with Russia, and I mean, if they're okay with Vladimir coming in and doing this whole thing, and if they really are like those cool people in the pictures taking the sandwiches and selfies, well, then I guess that's up to them. But either way, I don't think it's for us to be involved in at this point.
Yeah, I agree.
The reason, Greg, that we brought Dan on today, and we'll kind of have to shift gears here real quick for the sake of time, is because of Jan Brewer's veto of Arizona Senate Bill 1062. And give us a little bit of details just about what that was and what the situation was this week, and then we'll get into Dan's take on that.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you what. I'm going to let Dan go ahead and break it down since he was the one that wrote the article.
All right. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay. Well, basically, we've all heard about the so-called religious freedom bill in Arizona. I didn't get to write on all of the possible flaws and angles in this bill because I was trying to exert some self-discipline and keep it under one page long. But anyway, it was written in such broad terms. Rashad and I were going through it on the way over here, and it dawned on me, you could have used this as grounds for not serving a single mom or someone who you thought was dressing odd. What it did was it gave you the authority to deny your business doing service to someone if it conflicts with your religious views. There's nothing wrong with that on the surface. The trouble is that they're defining it as religious. You should be able to use your own discretion, rationality, for whatever reason you think, not just for the reasons that government sanctions. such as if you think that someone is going to be, let's say, a black person. They own a bakery, and then two Klansmen come in and want to buy a cake for their next cookout. Should the black man have to serve the two Klansmen, even though they're advancing a philosophy and ideology that's horrible and in complete contradiction to what the bakery owner might believe? That's okay. But the trouble is, we always talk about freedom and bills and completely ignore that that's an inherent contradiction in terms. A freedom is something that exists. We don't need permission from the government for it. We don't have to pass a law in order to have the freedom of speech. A law, however, does have to be passed in order to impede that freedom. And we are constantly forgetting that, and that's why so many libertarians were actually supporting this bill. They forgot that freedom does not come from government, and that's what the entire article was about.
Well, it was a great piece, and it's up at wearelibertarians.com for anyone that wants to read it in full. But I thought Dan's direction that he took with it was pretty spot on. Greg, you did too, right?
Well, I agree. I agree completely. It's funny. It really, though, made me ask some questions, and just for me personally. And the first question that I had to ask myself and do some introspection was, should a business owner be allowed to have choice in who he deals with? And initially, on the surface, I thought, well, of course, right? Absolutely. And then I kind of got to thinking, I was like, is there ever a situation where he should be forced to? And the only thing that occurred to me was, well, let's say that we lived in Arizona. And Arizona was able to pass a law that said that that business owners were not could deny service and goods and sale to homosexual, to anyone based on their religious views. Now, let's say that a utility company came under the control of a fundamental Christian. Could that utility company decide to turn off the water from a homosexual and stop that person from getting publicly available water that is already hooked up to their home? And just for the sake of the argument, this is a very deep hypothetical, because obviously they could go to a store and buy water from that it was bottled. But that's a human necessity for life. If he was able to deny water to that homosexual individual, am I okay with that? And I struggled with that. What do you guys think about that?
Well, utilities are a monopoly because the government enables them to be a monopoly. It's a very flawed example for that exact reason. If I would agree with you, but that's not a case of the free market. It's a case of a mixed economy, and you have to have all government services available to all citizens. So it's impossible to answer in the context that you're asking.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that.
I agree, and I know that. That's why I understand that. But the fact of the matter is, let's say it's Alabama. Mm-hmm. And in Alabama, that is a very Christian conservative state. In one municipality, for instance, they wanted to put the Ten Commandments up in front of the courthouse. And I forget exactly what city it was. But they decide there's a homosexual. They pass this law. And that person no longer has access to public water. Granted, the government caused the problem. But that problem still, in fact, exists, and we're forced to deal with reality.
Seems crazy.
And that's why the closest thing that I could think about was the Civil Rights Act. And the Civil Rights Act, to me, was – it violated my principles in theory, but it was one of those times – where I've said this before – where the eggs of small government were worth the omelet. And so it increased freedom in theory and in emotion. Did it necessarily create more headaches? Like, that's the reason Jan Brewer vetoed this, is it was going to create more headaches than it was worth. Civil Rights Act, ultimately the same thing. But that emotion behind it, I can sympathize with and understand. And so I do think there is a – when you have this government utility that is sanctioned, maybe you need something like that as a protection.
No, you just need the principle that every citizen is going to have access to government services. You don't need to get more specific than that, because then it can be used as a tool for expanding the reach of government.
No.
Are they paying into those utilities? Are they paying into those government services?
They're paying into the government services, but it's a private company that's a monopoly. It's like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. It's a government-sponsored entity.
But that's not a free market situation.
No, but it's a real situation.
you're talking about a political company, and politics is open to every taxpayer. What you're talking about is a complete breach of civil rights and the absolute definition of the word. We always talk about civil rights in a way that it does not mean. Civil rights is having access to government services that you have a right to. This is a case of that. It isn't a case of economic freedom at all.
So, but the point is, so would you say then in this scenario, the law wouldn't be necessary because of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution?
For a federal service, yes.
Not for a state-administered service. So if the state didn't have an Equal Protection Clause and that civil rights clause wasn't in their state constitution or on the books, would it be a good thing in reality to actually do that?
No, you would need something much broader than that, saying that every taxpayer has equal opportunity to government services rather than making anything specific.
And so can a libertarian support something like that if it's at a state level?
A libertarian wouldn't support a mixed economy in the first place. You're rigging the game against libertarians if you're
forcing us
to accept
that. Oh, for sure. No, absolutely.
Because
the government is the culprit in this scenario.
Yeah, because what you would do is as soon as the mixed economy model will collapse, and it will, if libertarians put their stamp of approval in any way, shape, or form, they're going to point their finger at us and blame it on us, sort of like Alan Greenspan being in charge of the Fed. You know, you can't ever try to compromise because you will get blamed.
I just want to clarify with you real quick, Greg. This person that you're referring to in Alabama, they're paying for services but not receiving the services because the service is outsourced to a private company?
Yep. And it's a public monopoly, like an IPL, Indianapolis Power and Light here. Like, for instance, maybe this homosexual wasn't allowed electricity in Indianapolis because IPL is privately owned, but they're a government-sponsored entity. They're a monopoly that the government allows. But it's privately owned, so they decide, in fact, to deny service to any homosexual based on a law that almost passed in Arizona if the governor hadn't vetoed. If that scenario arises, what protection – is there ever a time when it's okay to pass a law that it's just purely dealing with reality? It's dealing with the situation where, no, you cannot religiously discriminate as a business owner regardless. Is there
ever – Well, I think to have another law like what with – you know, what you're referring to in Indianapolis, to make another law saying that discrimination will not be allowed – from this private company that's government-sponsored and a government-allowed monopoly, then that would be problematic because, you know, you wouldn't need another law per se because it shouldn't be allowed in the first place. You should, you know, if the government is going to allow or sponsor a private company, then that discrimination, you know, I guess the ability for them to do business with whoever they want to do business with, then at that point goes away.
Yeah, and I agree wholeheartedly with that. The government allows the situation to arise. They are the ultimate cause. But there are certain times like when – like we can't just – if this situation did happen, we couldn't just say, well, government, you're done. You know what I mean? Like that doesn't solve the solution of the person not able to get electricity or water. It's an issue of practical thing.
Dude needs to get his money back.
Well, I would like to take this on a completely different angle that I think that we were ignoring. Notice that you had to come up with such an extreme example in order to have an argument against the position of allowing free market discrimination. You had to come up with a monopoly, which are very hard to come by. You had to come up with a situation that's never before arisen, and then several others. I think that alone should be some comfort in that Americans can be trusted with their own freedom and that the free market is what we should deal with since all objections are of such an outlandish nature.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. That question occurred to me. And so I found it interesting is merely all. I just kind of wanted to kick it around and see. And it was one of those things where is there ever a situation where you can not necessarily abandon principle but turn legislation around and use it for liberty-promoting purposes when I guess you could say that something was set up incorrectly?
Well, as a metaphor, I don't like mixing water in my scotch. This would kind of be the same example. I don't like mixing government and my liberty. I wouldn't want a compromise of trying to make a government-run company as capitalist as I can. That's just idiotic. It's a fool's errand.
And for that guy in Alabama, like I was saying earlier, I'd say take the damn water. Because what are they going to do? Arrest the guy for trying to get some water, and then you stir up an entire conversation nationally and have a case where things are going to go in your direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, yeah, that was my only thing, and because I agree with Dan wholeheartedly, especially his piece, thought it was fantastic. But that just kind of popped up, and I wanted to kind of kick it around, I guess, and see if that was something interesting to you guys whatsoever.
Definitely. Well, at this point, Greg, I see your beer is about coming to an end there.
Uh-huh,
do we,
it is.
Do you
want to
go ahead and just try and wrap up the conversation for the night?
Yeah, I think it's probably a good place to end this week. And Joe, I'll let you wrap this thing up.
We definitely thank Dan Van Doren for being on the show.
Yes, Dan, thank you so much for appearing, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Glad to come. I've been wanting to for a while.
Well, we appreciate
he's one
it
of those guys sitting at home, and now he's got his friend named Rashad. Rashad, hello. Someday we'll have to get you on too. Rashad is the admin of the African American Libertarians page on Facebook. If you can look that up and like that page, I'm sure he'd appreciate it. We'll have to get him on sometime too, Greg.
That would be great. That'd be great.
Because Dan said he was jealous that he got to be on the program tonight. just for you know, to get a little bit of hype going, because we always plug something at the end of the program, we are going to have a special show Wednesday night. Greg will be producing the show out of Chicago, I guess, but we're going to have a special guest in Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. So that'll be really cool to talk to him. He is a Austrian economist, and he's very in tune with the things that are happening in the drug war and some other things that we'll be discussing. So it'll be fun to talk with him. And I heard he's a pretty awesome guy, so I look forward to meeting him for the first time.
Absolutely. I can't wait to do it on Wednesday. It should be a blast.
Yeah. Dan, did you have anything you want to plug real quick before we take off?
No. Take it away.
Greg, you?
All I'd say is John Kerry is going to be heading over to the Ukraine to help set up hopefully a government. And then the Klitschko brother has said he is going to run as president of the new Ukrainian government.
Interesting.
So we will have a heavyweight champion going up against Putin. It should be. I say they just settle this whole thing in a boxing match, and Ukraine will come away victorious.
Yeah, Olympics part two.
Exactly. If they, you know, if Vladimir Putin has any sack at all, he will accept Klitschko's challenge, man to man.
I will accept your challenge. All right. Well, thank you for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. We really hope to find out where Chris Spangle is. Again, if you have any information about his whereabouts, we're still interested to know how we can get a hold of Chris and get him back on the program, why he left us, or you know, if he did it voluntarily or whatever. But we do look forward to his return, and hopefully that will happen soon somehow. And for the rest of us here on We Are Libertarians, we thank you for joining us. And as always, we promise
to do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.